time for Sports Lit 101. Now, Bruce, I'm going to tell you up front, we were just reminded by Zoom. They must have known we were talking about them, that they've changed their rules, and it's a 40-minute limit. So we're going to lose you fairly soon, but what we'll do if that happens, we'll take a break, and then we'll open up a new session and reconnect.
Right, yeah, I just saw that it said time left 8 minutes. So. Yeah, so anyway, the quick skinny on the book is that Stephen Wynn and Robert K. Barney, the authors, wrote a book back in 2001 that was titled Selling the Five Rings, The International Olympic Committee and the Rise of Olympic Commercialism. And I talked about that book briefly along with some others, but I didn't see it when it came out, and I got a copy later. This just came out last year. And it's fascinating because there's so much about early Olympic history that we don't know as a country and a society, because none of us were alive then. But when Baron de Couperin and Avery Brundage were the two major players in the National Olympic movement, you had two wealthy men who had grown up poor, had each lost a family member when they were very young, had wanted to be really good athletes. And what de Couperin did was use his incredible wealth. He had a great deal of money, and created the symbol of the five rings. We can go into exactly how that happened later, but no one ever did the legal work to protect that. So that when a very enterprising young guy named Paul Helms, who was a baker, who had a very similar experience, grew up poor, lost a parent when he was young, went into business. He became a baker in New York, did very well. His health suffered. He needed to move to a better climate. He moved to LA. He became a very successful manufacturer of bread, one of which was called Olympic Bread, and used the five rings and became incredibly successful. Thousands of bread routes, tremendous amount of money. He turned a lot of that money toward the Olympic movement because he believed in it. And like Avery Brundage and like Baron de Couperin, they were all troubled by where do you draw the line between staying amateur as without commercialism and then making the Olympics better by having more money. Well, the things to change all that, of course, are first radio. You can broadcast the Olympics, their radio rights. Then there's television, starting in the 40s and 50s. Then there becomes the expanded television and the ability to report directly from all around the world and to have things on delay. Then there comes the internet and cyberspace and all this. And as it goes, the Olympic Committee, International Olympic Committee's assets go from like 100,000 to billions. And in the course of that, Brundage wants very much, when he's in charge in the last part of the last century, before Juan Antonio Samaranch, he wants to be absolutely sure that the money is going into the right hands. But he's also greedy, and he wants more money. And he's a very unpleasant person, Avery Brundage, apparently. So he goes after Paul Helms in a number of lawsuits and legal arguments for years, trying to take away Helms' right to use the Olympic symbols, which he does not really want to do, but feels he has to do. Of course, meanwhile, people are getting a cut of the pie. And a lot of the people that are getting a cut of the pie are the various national Olympic committees. And in the US, the US goes, and it's because we're a more litigious country, and we start to establish benefits for the United States Olympic Association, then later the USOC, others don't have, like codifying them as a tax-exempt organization. Once that happens, the corporate money comes flying in and is able to really influence how things move forward. Brundage felt this need to both protect, ravenously, zealously protect the Olympics, but by the same token, he wanted to run it himself. He didn't want a lot of underlings or hirelings, because he felt that was sort of the backdoor way in which corruption could leak into the Olympics. Excuse me. Which is all great until we start getting into doping scandals, and we get into the Salt Lake rigged bid, and we get into the issues that will affect the Olympics in other ways in terms of commercialism. But this story of Paul Helms and Avery Brundage is really a remarkable tale because in the end, a guy named Terry McGovern, who was a first-generation Irish-American lawyer from Albany, spends several years as the mediator and finally comes up with a conciliatory way to appease both Helms and to thank him for his dedication and service to the Olympic movement and to have him relinquish his use of Olympic bread as linked to the Olympic movement. And there were other countries that did business with Helms over time. And he appears to be a man that the only person who didn't like him in the whole world was Avery Brundage. He appears to be a very self-effacing, decent guy who's had battled a lot of health problems. But what this chapter, this first chapter in the book did that was really amazing to me was show how there was a time when people didn't even think about these things, about licensing, and they didn't think about copywriting, and they didn't think about it because they didn't think it was necessary. They thought that everybody was honorable, and of course that's not always the case.
What? Not always the case in the Olympic movement?
Yeah, and it's the other thing that's interesting is you think back about how when the first LA Olympics came around, they could put all the women athletes in a hotel, and they had to build one small village for the men. That it was a so much smaller undertaking. As I recall, in 1960, if I'm not exactly right, I'm close. The Winter Olympics had 18 events.
Wow,
we got to have 18 skiing events now. You know, there was no luge, there was no skeleton, there was no ice dancing, there was figure skating, alpine skiing, cross-country skiing, there was no biathlon in those Olympics, you know, many of the other things that they had weren't there. So anyway, what this book does, and as I mentioned earlier, I haven't gotten through all the articles yet, talks about these key moments. The Melbourne Olympics in 1956 were highly politicized because they were going to be held for the first time in Australia, that far from major markets. How are things going to go? Rome was marketed very well. It became a big Olympic. Then we get to the next one they take on is the legacy of Munich in 1972 of television. How television and the Olympics changed after the massacre in Munich. And we haven't ever really watched the Olympics the same way. And that brought us a lot more of those sort of, quote, up close and personal and the other stories. The development of the Total Olympic Program, which is the way that corporate money is funneled in, is one. And then they'll talk about the Salt Lake bidding scandal, some others, and the incredible 2009 Copenhagen session of the IOC where Brazil ended up, and Rio ended up winning the bid for the Olympics when everybody thought Chicago, with Barack Obama's backing, or Tokyo, was clearly had the inside track, and some of the machinations that went on with that. And now over time we've heard perhaps that wasn't completely on the up and up either when it came to how that bid was worked out. But I think it's even though we're not, you know, there's no Olympics staring us down, this is really a good time to examine this kind of thing and look forward to that as name, image, and likeness comes into the NCAA in the same kind of way, which does get a little bit of touched on in this.
And Avery Brundage, boy, the more you read about him, what a just a colossally bad, corrupt guy.
Yeah, and the thing is, what's so odd is that he, in some ways, I mean, he did some amazingly good things for the Olympics, but his personality was just so toxic for others. And boy, when it came to looking the other way when he wanted to, and not looking the other way when he thought it was what he should do, he was, we'll put it politely, inconsistent.
Yeah. What's the name of the book again, Bruce?
It's called The Gold in the Rings, The People and Events That Transformed the Olympic Games by Wen, W-E-N-N, and Barney. It's from University of Illinois Press, which, of course, has given us books by Dick Kripow and Ron Smith and others. So we're always good to get books from them.
Great. What's coming up next week in future Sports Lits?
Well, I'm going to talk about a couple more of the chapters in this book in the next couple of weeks, and hopefully we'll have our friend Jack Gilden, Collision of Wills, new book should be in my mailbox when I get home. So I'm going to look forward to jumping on that right away. And then we also got a a chance to look again at some books about sort of other NCAA things that should be examined.
Excellent. We'll look forward to all that. Bruce Pratt, Sports Lit 101 every Wednesday afternoon.